Hello, this is Richard Gillis, and welcome to Unofficial Partner. This week's guest is Henry Chappell, founder of Pitch Marketing Group. We talk about how Henry got started at IMG and Freud's and where he thinks the agency market is going. He's always good company and is someone whose views are worth hearing on a range of topics.
We still think the value that agencies can bring is on the idea side of things, which is still an absolutely vital component of marketing, whatever the discipline, whatever you're doing.
If you're listening to the podcasts, you can rate us on iTunes as it makes us look popular and helps people find us. Also, a special welcome to our listeners from the Marketing Society who have recently come on board. Feel free to go back and listen to our back catalogue of interviews with people from across sport, marketing and the business world. You can access them free via Apple or via the Unofficial Partner site. Here's Henry Chappell.
I'm looking out over this room, and the average age of those people out there, Henry, we're now looking out into your
office. Well, we're looking at the second floor of our office, which is kind of like where most of the magic happens, and the average age is probably about 25 and a half, I'd imagine.
Scary. It's scary how young people are these days. Irritatingly, PR Week said that you weren't aging, but close up, it obviously is you are.
We've got a few wrinkles, haven't
we? At last.
I know why I say that, because I've always looked young. And when you're a 28-year-old, 29-year-old starting up your own business as I was, and you still look about 17, it's not advantageous. No.
So gravitas is very. I exude gravitas. That's my big calling card. You see,
I always yearn to look older, but now I am older. You know, I'm in the kind of veteran territory.
Have you had any work done?
Not recently.
I think you must say maybe there's a little bit going on.
No,
it's disappointing.
Not that I'd admit it on really this podcast. On another one. it's just natural youthfulness.
So you have been in this office. Well, you're not you, but you personally.
Yeah.
But and we should say we're in deepest Soho, Brewer Street, the Pitch Marketing offices.
39-43 Brewer Street, which is the home of Pitch Marketing Group, and this is where we first set up shop 2002.
2002 is extraordinary. You've been going that long. Yeah. Not that you shouldn't be going that long, but back to your boyishly attractive face. You can overlook the NCP car park from here, which is one of the things. When I used to come here years ago, you used to have the magazine shop below.
Yeah. Did you used to go to it?
Well, it was a reason to come here.
we spotted. It's a funny story, actually, because when we first moved in here, it was less gentrified than it is now. So there were more sort of dodgy establishments. And I think we were starting to do some work with HSBC, which for us was quite a big thing as a new business. And William Parry, who was the sponsorship chief of HSBC.
Is that the pre-Giles Morgan era?
Yeah, pre-Giles Morgan. Again,
wow.
Dates me, right?
So blimey, O'Reilly. How old are you?
Army officer. I'm 45. And he's an ex-army officer. Very prim guy. Head of sponsorship for HSBC. We were working on the Education Trust, doing some sailing sponsorship. And he came back to our office for a meeting after a meeting elsewhere, and we walked up the road up Great Windmill Street. And the night before, I'd been having drinks in the pub opposite with some of the people who work here. And outside, on the streets, the girls, ladies of the night would hang out and try and coax people into the establishments. And we were just outside drinking, probably having a cigarette, and one of the girls was talking to us, and what's your name, love? And I said, oh, Henry. And she's like, come on, no, I'm right, I'm not, and no, thank you very much, all very polite. End of conversation.
Was she Welsh, this woman?
Just Cockney.
interesting right, accent that you threw in there.
Anyway, but the next day I'm marching up Great Windmill Street with William Parry, and it's like 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the same girl outside on the street. All right, Henry, how's it going? William Parry looked at me.
That's the authentic, agency story. That's what we want.
But anyway, they didn't fire us. But and I did never went into that establishment.
Who was the first pitch client?
Tracy Edwards.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So the first. So the backstory of Pitch. And I go back to my first job in the industry and how I first got into it.
Come on then, let's go there.
Well, my first job in the industry was selling fanzines outside Old Trafford.
Oh, yes.
United We Stand, which was set up by a guy called Andy Mitten, who still runs it to this day. He's a very well-known journalist.
Got a job at The Athletic, hasn't he?
He has, yeah. And Andy employed me to help sell his fanzines outside Old Trafford when I was at university there, when I was 18, 19. And it paid for me to watch United home and away. And amongst not going to lectures.
which involved a short stay in a Turkish prison cell when we were all arrested and when we went to watch United play Galatasaray. So we were deported from the country and had a pretty scary 48 hours in behind bars, unfairly, or one of those times where everyone was arrested en masse, whether you were doing
just
anything.
Just for being a Man United fan?
Just for being a Man United fan. Many people would like that
was
story.
Was it like Midnight Express?
It was pretty scary. Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was full on.
An 18-year-old Henry Chappell in a Turkish prison.
A lot of people would like to see that. Probably.
That's a whole film in its own right, isn't it? And I think I might have seen it at some point.
We survived. United won the league again. Everything was good. And then when I left Manchester University, I got a real job. I was at IMG, but I wasn't well qualified enough to get a job on their internship program, which was very successful back in the day. But yeah. I was. My aunt had worked at IMG for many years, Sarah Waldridge, and so she managed to get me.
I didn't know that.
She managed to get me a job in the fax operating room, so sending faxes.
So she, Sarah Waldridge, runs. I know Sarah Waldridge.
Yeah, he was married to Ian Waldridge, a great journalist, and she.
And is that your uncle?
Well, yeah, Sarah's my through marriage. Yeah, so right. Sarah's my dad's sister, and Sarah was, I believe, IMG's first ever employee in London. I think the second one was Martin Sorrell.
She tells fantastic McCormack stories.
She's been there. She's an amazing woman. She's still working there. She's still doing it. Amazing. And again, she's got a fantastic career she's had. And a huge respect to her for everything that she's done in this industry. And she's, she's the Kensington Bugle. She knows everything that's going on. Yeah. You could do a podcast on her personally. I think she'd tell you some great stories. But she got me a job at IMG sending the faxes, which there's a couple of things to say on that, which again back to the point of how young the team is here, is that a few weeks ago I was telling the story of how I first got in the sports industry doing that, and I told that story and one of them, any questions, one of them I said, what's a fax machine? Oh, for fuck's sake. Really? But yeah, millennials.
Idiots, so. Aren't they? all millennials, they're idiots. I've always said this.
But the other good thing about it, there was it in those days, it was pre-email, right? This is pre-email, 1995, 6, 7, something like that. In Peer House, IMG. Literally every piece of written communication to the outside world through IMG went through that fax room. So one, you had leverage, you literally, and secondly, you could read every one. So, it was actually a really good education and, how much a sponsor pays Michael Schumacher or whoever it may be. I just read every one. So I worked there for a year on an hourly rate and I'd work, it was quite good money because of the hours. But until I realised that I had to get a proper job. I couldn't just send faxes all my life because eventually faxes would come out of fashion. Then I got a job at Freud's through, someone I met. I met Matthew Freud's nephew, Tom Freud. And that was amazing because I was suddenly 22, 23 into this red hot Soho agency. And because of my passion and interest in sport, they kind of threw me into the sports stuff. And within 6 months of joining, I think, or very early on, we were just started work. Freud's had just sold to AMV, the big Abermead Vickers, the big kind of advertising agency in the UK. And we started working at Pizza Hut. And so it was Euro 96 and the famous Gareth Southgate, Chris Waddle, Stuart Pearce, Pizza Hut commercial, where they all missed penalties and they're in an ad,
And some of us have never really forgiven Gareth Southgate for that advert.
Well, it was a great campaign. That was my first.
Was it your idea?
It wasn't my idea, sadly, but it was the first. Give me a chance. I was only at 24 at the time, but it was the first big.
But you'd probably read about it in IMG's post room.
It was the first big marketing campaign, national marketing campaign I've been involved with. And again, I'll be, all the way through and working with the, it's kind of great to the game. It was, and that's what Freud's did. Didn't really matter how old you were or how young you looked. If you were kind of thrown in at a deep end and there's being thrown. There's got another good story. Is that about a year later, we'd Planet Hollywood was a big client of Freud's, and did all their openings globally. If you remember Planet Hollywood, big themed restaurant with Sly Stallone, Arnold Schwarzenegger, everyone.
Yeah, I remember that.
It was a big. And Robert Earl was the British mogul behind it, and Matthew was very well connected with him. He launched an offshoot called the Official All Star Cafe.
Right.
Which was a sports version of themed restaurants. And so in the late 90s, themed restaurants were all the rage. And so rather than Sly Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger, his lineup was Andre Agassi, Shaquille O'Neal, Wayne Gretzky, I think Monica Seles, someone like that.
And we did the opening of the official All-Star Cafe in Miami, South Beach, Miami.
Right.
And this is why the story came to mind, because you were talking about being thrown at the deep end. Because we flew out with Piers Morgan, I think, who was the celebrity editor of The Mirror at the time, at 3 a.m., whatever it's called, to do the exclusive opening. He was going to get exclusive interviews with all the celebrities who were going to be there and the rest of it. We get there, and of course, Piers Morgan, it's not quite enough, right? There's no one really interesting for him. He's supposed to be doing a double page spread, going to be a big. So he came up with the idea. So tell you what would make Shaquille O'Neal throws me in the pool.
Right.
That's brilliant. That's what I want. That's front page. That's front page splash.
Yeah.
You know, loving all of this. So we're going to probably need 25 at this time. So a 5 for 8 of me has to go up to Shaquille O'Neal and his people and persuade him to throw that British journalist in the pool. And it did. We made it happen. And I think someone like Dave Hogan and one of the celebrity photographers there. We got a great set of pictures. We got a great story. And so I think the next big thing after the Pizza Hut campaign was Shaquille O'Neal throwing Piers Morgan in a pool, and at this point I'm going, there's something here.
So when did you when did pitch appear?
We were trying to do sport one way or another, as everyone tries to do sport, and but they weren't really bought into. I'd lined up a meeting with Man United when Peter Kenyon was there. I went up to see them, and Matthew was supposed to come. I think he just couldn't be asked to come, and suddenly. A 27-year-old was presenting to Peter Kenyon on.
Yeah. It's like a Star Trek episode. You're getting older. every campaign, you get 3 years older.
The long and the short of it was that we talked about it. It wasn't happening. And then not just Matthew Froese, he had a very good right-hand man who ran their business called Nick Vigevatti, who you won't know because he was the kind of the clever but straight man behind it all. Who's actually his wife had worked at IMG and there's been a connection there. But when I just eventually made sense to go on our own, or me to go on my own, but rather than completely on my own, I've come to realize that anyone can set up an agency, and actually it's the easiest thing in the world to do. Which is part of the problem, because you literally need no capital, no
tech.
You
can call yourself a sports marketing agency.
I just need a phone, right? And you don't even need a client, because we didn't have, back to your question about half an hour ago, because we didn't even have a client, right? I just sort of thought, right, I could do this, it makes sense to do it on my own, rather than, for Freud's. And for whatever reason, they kind of thought, okay, rather than just me leaving and, having a leaving drinks and off I go, they said no, let's invest in you. And so Freud's put some money into the business and became a minority shareholder in it, which they maintained that shareholding until 2012. So for 10 years basically they had it in there, and it was a few ups and downs, and I kind of thought, great, now I've got Freud's backing, I just need to get a premises. I met a guy called Will Muirhead, who was at the forefront of sports video on mobile phone, and was pioneering guy who had a big contract with Vodafone to broadcast, to put Champions League football onto mobile phones, and a company called Sport TV. And this is a very early version of Perform, and if you ask like Ollie Slipper, they were all going, guy Will Muirhead is like, and he's real visionary. And so Will Muirhead wanted somebody to help do some PR and make some noise about Sport TV, and he hired us, but in return for, rather than giving us money, he let me, and I had one employee starting off, a girl called Victoria Fuller, who was a family friend of the Freuds, and so that's why she came along. And me and Victoria were given, over in that corner by the window overlooking the NCP car park, two little desks in the corner, and that's where we started.
So whose office was this then?
This was Sport TV's office.
Oh, I see.
It was their office, and they basically... We did sort of 6 months worth of work in return for some free office space.
And when was the first time you thought, okay, this is going to work? This is the first big moment you went home and thought, oh, blimey, I've got a business.
Yeah, so the problem was we set up and there was like, right, okay, I got Freud's backing, I've got a premises, we didn't have any clients. And it was like, okay, now what do we do? And I kind of thought at that point, well, if it doesn't really work out in a year, at that time I wasn't married, I didn't have kids, I kind of thought I could just go back to Freud or do something else. So it was no real
flogging magazines at culture.
Something I do. I didn't
go
really,
back to
I
the Turkish prison where you made all those friends.
I didn't have that much of a plan, Richard. Unfortunately, I just thought I don't know. But I thought, no, let's get some clients quick. So through Tracy Edwards, I'd met along the way, and she had a book launch. She was a famous yachtswoman and one of the first women to sail around the world.
Yes.
Sort of pre-Ellen MacArthur.
Yeah.
So I think Hodder and Stout were doing her autobiography. I think they paid us 10 grand, which is quite good money for a book launch.
Yeah.
I think that was the first gig we were up and running. And we were kicking along, but I think the first time I thought, okay, we're up and running, is we won... we were appointed by Mark Davies, the son of Barry Davies,
yes,
the commentator, who was at Betfair.
Right,
and it was Betfair in very early stages. They were not publicly listed. They were owned privately by Andrew Black and Ed Ray. And they were a tech startup trying to disrupt the betting sector.
Yeah.
And they hired us in 2002, I believe, or 2000. So that was like, okay. And it was a big, you know, for us, you know, retainer to do some proper ongoing PR sponsorship work. And they haven't always hired us, but obviously if you fast forward to some of the best work we've done most recently, like the Victoria Pendleton Switching Saddles campaign or the Rio Ferdinand campaign, and they're still a client today. Yeah. You know, it's been a great journey we've been on with them all the way through. So that was a big moment. A second one was another client we've had ever since. So we had them for 13 years. So I can't remember exactly when this would have been, but it must have been 2006 or 7. We won the NBA as a client.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that was when they were first staging games in London and Europe. So NBA Europe Live. So it was 2006.
Yeah.
So I think it was about 3 or 4 years in it took me to, when we won that, and that was a pan-European appointment. That was, you know, that for me was a moment where it was like, okay, I actually got something.
You're doing PR.
Yeah.
You're leading a PR, and now you're called Pitch Marketing. That move, presumably, is in response to just wanting to be broader, do different things.
Yeah. I mean, we still do PR, and I still believe PR is a very important and effective marketing channel. That's good. And we've got some very significant PR contracts, you know, with BT and the NBA and ASICS and what have you. But for some time, it's not PR used to be a dirty word. I think it's a dirty word. I think there's a lot of people see value in it. But for some time we've been doing work a lot broader than just PR. And, you know, we were in situations where, say, we were pitching to Tag Heuer to do their sponsorship consulting when they were looking to get into football a number of years ago. And it was to their marketing team for a sponsorship brief.
Yeah.
And we were still called Pitch PR. And it just doesn't help you that you have to start that conversation by, explaining the other work that you do. So, and fun enough, we never actually had been called Pitch PR. We were Pitch Media Limited, actually, originally, I think, was. But we were known, because of alliteration, as Pitch PR.
Yeah.
There is obviously, of course, Pitch International in the marketplace as well, which I only found about 5 years after we were both formed, more or less at the same time. So I think we, in about 2016, when we did the repositioning, you know, for a few years we'd been having kind of issues with the fact that we're broader than people could see that the production of content is a very important growth of the business, of the industry across the board, and you need to have kind of that content production capabilities, and we wanted to do more wider sponsorship strategy and activation work. So we looked at, you know, should we call it a different name altogether? You know, and you know that was definitely an option.
What were the option? What was that brainstorm like?
I didn't think it lasted very long, to be fair. But I think we did have other stupid names to add to it, like calling it Pitch something else. You know, Pitch and Putt, or probably someone came up with something really crap. But no, but it was. But I think it was. I think we just needed something to replace the PR. That was all it was, and then have PR underneath it. So so Pitch Marketing Group is. You know, it's a, you know, okay, we employ 55 people here, but we've got 3 different divisions, so it's a bit over the top. So we're a group, but it does imply we do have teams or groups of people that have different expertise. You know, upstairs we've got, you know, 8 people in our production unit that's producing content for Ferrari, for Hyundai, for Tag Heuer, you know, of the highest caliber.
Yeah.
And we've got 20 odd people plus people in the PR department still who are, you know, really good at communications, influencer marketing, and all of that. And you know, we're investing in the sponsorship side of things, and I mean, Luke Wilson has just joined us from team, and you know, to head up the partnerships division, which is trying to do more sort of so within those groups, you know, within those teams, there's groups of expertise. And
so they're just on the partnerships thing. You're not are you selling rights, or are you
no, not at the moment. You never know in the future. I've always kind of considered it, but think there's, I think it's a different, not that you can't do it, because I remember always Karen Earl and Synergy would always be kind of like, yes. You know, you can't do it. I think you can do it, but it's a very different discipline. And you need different expertise, and there's some very good players in the marketplace on a sort of a global level, the IMGs or CAAs or those guys, and then you know domestically, you know people like TRM and you know who've come on the scene, who Pitch International, who do that bit very well.
Yeah.
And so no, we don't do that, and I don't see that as an area that we're.
So what does the partnerships team do? They are
strategy and activation, really. So okay. It's like, you know, for example, for Hyundai, is always the best way to give an example of a client. Again, Hyundai look for an agency to help move their strategy away from, still in football, but sponsoring the big international tournaments every 4 years or whatever, to having an always-on, ongoing in involvement with brands at a more domestic level. So they've gone into club sponsorship, and we've helped them do, you know, partnerships with a club in each of the five key European markets, and then create an umbrella pan-European campaign for that to sit on,
to
sit under. And so, you know, it was a different way of thinking around it. And so we're sort of helping them all the way through on that journey. And, you know, that's, we end up doing quite a bit of PR or content off the back of it, but the client sits within the partnerships team, because ultimately it's a sponsorship program.
So when you look at the agency market now, so the sports specific agency market, you've got a number of people claiming to do everything.
Yeah.
So you've got that, I mean, everyone says they do content, and lots of people talk about partnerships and things. And I'm just wondering how you think this is going to evolve, because you must be one of the larger independent agencies, presumably, because you've got big networks.
Not
doing
counted, but well, probably
the
we
networks
are.
Thing, and then you've got small shops, you know, who are doing bits and bobs. But you're sort of in that, I guess, in the middle of those two extremes. What's your take on the agency market now, today? Is it? Do you think this is really thriving, or is there problems for the?
I don't know about the future. I don't want to predict the future, because fuck knows, you know? Okay. Sorry, I'm gonna
swear. So as of today.
I don't. But what's true, no one can tell. But as of today, it's difficult.
Yeah.
It's really difficult now, I think. And that is because you're competing with so many people, right? And yes, obviously, like-for-like competitors of all shapes and sizes. Literally. So one day we'll pitch against BBH and Mother. The next day we'll pitch against Frank and some other smaller specialist shop, whatever.
Yeah.
But you are all, secondly, you're also competing with global media platforms.
Yeah.
You know, so is it when we worked with Pepsi last year or around sort of football content, you know, in amongst that are Copa 90 and Facebook.
Yeah.
You know, and Facebook are saying to Pepsi globally, you know, probably New York to CMO board level, you know, spend as much money with us, not just on the media buy, but on, we own the customer, we can do the content, we do everything. They don't want an agency involved. We're competing with, and I've talked about like Copa 90s as well, they're a great media platform, but they're also kind of agencies.
They're an agency,
100% an agency. But we're competing with rights holders as well. Because if you look at the investment that across all rights holders, and quite a lot of rights holders are our clients, weird, but particularly football clubs, look at the investment in marketing resources that every Premier League club of note has made, particularly Manchester City, Liverpool, Manchester United, you know, not just on the sales side, but also on the partnership management activation. Because again, they want to do as much as possible because they don't want agencies involved if possible.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't if I was them, because their theory is they can have a better relationship, they can keep more of the revenue and keep the relationship, importantly, because the relationship is obviously critical.
From a client's perspective, it's very, I completely agree with you, but the argument for agencies presumably is a third party lens on that. If you take someone into Man United, they're going to be great at creating things around Man United's channels.
Of course, that's the argument, but, and I, as a
founder, I know you'll make that argument.
We're talking, and I, you know, and we've got to see, got to add value, but and the clients we work with obviously see that value, you know.
Yeah.
But I think my one was saying is what we're up against. But the last thing we're up against, we are also up against clients.
Yeah.
Because clients, you know, compared to like the 90s or, you know, early clients, you know, of all shapes and sizes have got all sorts of resources they didn't have in house. You know, banks have
content producers, you know. So if you were the HSBC example, you know, they, you would outsource it all. You know, I've just been told today, I think they're doing some football, you know, small football deal, but again, it's all been done in-house, you know.
Spurs, they've just done a Spurs deal.
A small football deal. I didn't mean that. I genuinely didn't mean that. But yes.
The bloody nerve of the man.
But that, so I think even the clients you've got, I think Steve Martin said this to me, that like you kind of even the clients, long term clients, you're kind of daily kind of competing them for the work.
Yeah.
Because they'll go, no, that's all right, we've got this. Yeah. You're like, oh, okay. It's another little, you know, and so it's I think as a result, the competitive landscape is tough. I think there's loads more opportunity than there used to be, and that's why, particularly if you can have different offerings without being a total generalist, I still think you have to have specialisms, which we have, because I think it's in danger if you're trying to do everything. Yeah. But so there's loads of opportunity still as a positive, but I think it is tougher because it's the competitive side of things. The other reason it's tougher is, but which has just been growing over year on year on year, but it's just pervasive and everywhere, is procurement, right? Which is just as worse than ever, and it's never going to get any better. So almost every commercial conversation you have with a client, prospective client, former client, you know, long-term client, whatever it is, has to involve, you know, procurement people or something, which takes up time, which inevitably costs you money. You know, it's just, you know, like I kind of get it in some respects, but I think it's when pitch processes are being led by procurement departments, it's just, you know, it's you know, and they're going, right, we're going to see 12 agencies for a long list because I've got nothing better to do. We're going to narrow it down to six, and then we'll have a it's like, you know, it's just it's not, you know. So I do sound like an old man now grumbling about it, but I do think it's very competitive. And I think it doesn't mean that everyone kind of plays, oh, agency model's dead. I don't think agency model's dead. And like in the same respects as things like when, you know, I don't know, the internet comes around and people say things like, you know, radio's dead. Well, then podcasts come out of it. Actually, it's another form of radio. Yeah. It's audio. So I think there is still a very important role for agencies. And I think there's, but you have to really focus on the where you sit in the value chain, and I think that is about we think, which is why we with our pitch marketing group and we focus more on the creative and the ideas, and we still think the value that agencies can bring is on the idea side of things, which is still an absolutely vital component of marketing, whatever the discipline, whatever you're doing. Without great ideas at the heart of it, your marketing is not effective.
What about generating your own IP? Is that an option?
Yes, and we would be interested in that, and that's definitely something we're looking to in the future, but just not just yet, or not quite ready to talk about it. But you know, I would see that as probably sitting adjacent to pitch marketing group. I don't think you want to pitch marketing group's got to be a servicing business, and it's got to be very clear about what its proposition is, even if it's tough out there and all the rest of it. And just get on with it, you know, and just be as good as you possibly can be, and know that there is enough opportunity out there that it's okay, and know where your place in the world is. And our place in the world is to help clients come up with great ideas and then take them to market. So as long as we're doing two things, great ideas, and then we're servicing clients really well and, you know, professionally delivering that really well, and you've got, obviously, we need really good people to do it. We're a people business, and that's also tough because there's obviously a lot of churn in the industry, and you have to accept it. You have to keep bringing good young people through the business, give them a chance to shine, give them the right direction, you know, and then at the top of the business, have people who can help, you know, we come up with the right strategy to deliver great ideas. That's just the formula. I don't think it's anything different from what, you know, our direct competitors would be doing. You just have to just do it the best you possibly can every day. And I think, you know, just have to kind of keep plugging away. You know, I didn't realize there isn't a persistent tenacity and just the, you know, resilience, and you just have to keep going. And before we came on air, you know, like I think we're talking about like the Warren Buffetts of this world, or people who are successful over time, you know, or, you know, like you have to accept that's what it is, you know. So, you know, you have to just kind of keep doing that and just keep trying to be as good as you possibly can be, because you're not going to get it right every time in this game. Because every client's different, looking for slightly different things. And, you know, in every pitch, you know, sometimes you have full knowledge of what they're looking for. Other times you're not really. You know, you kind of have a brief, and you might not know them as well. So you might not really get to the essence of it. So you kind of have to just keep going and then hope that, you know, you'll get yourself out there. There's enough opportunity to kind of grow a bit and keep doing slightly better work than you did last year.
What about the influencer market? Let's talk about that. Is that something you see as different than traditional comms?
Yeah, well, we do. It's just a positioning thing. We're very active in that area, have been for years. I think influencer marketing is a subset of PR, personally. That's the way I see it. So it sits within our PR division. And we actively do it, but just it's very on trend. So then agencies that come out there with influencer marketing do pretty well. I think people like Goat kind of, you know, they're not just a sports business. They're an influencer marketing business. And then they make some noise in different verticals where they've had some success. So it's slightly different, if you see what I mean. And it's true, the same for us in separate, because I always say this, we're not a sports business either. We're a marketing business. We are not in the sports industry. We're in the marketing services industry. But just so happens to have done a lot of work in the sports sector, and that's an area we, not exclusively, but have, you know, put a lot of focus on and have built up a good reputation in. So our challenges perhaps, you know, is to be able to go, okay, we've done a great influencer marketing campaign for Beats recently, for example, the headphone business, which is not a sports client. You know, we do work with them across, you know, their portfolio of consumer products. Our relationship with them originated with the Euros campaign with Harry Kane in it from a few years ago. But, you know, it's broadened into wider ongoing consumer marketing role, which is fabulous. You know, it's exactly what we want to be doing. But we need to be able to do the same as, you know, for that kind of influencer marketing campaign with, you know, a wider array of brands, no matter what the brief is, really. And so I think influencer marketing is, you know, yeah, it's a really good way for brands, obviously, to reach consumers directly. But I think it should be part of a wider campaign. And my belief in it, that comes from having a great strategy and a great campaign idea at the heart. And then you start to think, right, how can we make this work in PR and influencer marketing? How do you extend the engagement, levels of engagement and reach with us through social media, or whatever it might be? That's the way I prefer to look at it. And I think the best work you do starts that way around, if you see what I mean. Not just a client going, right, I need a bit of influencer marketing. That's pretty tactical and variably, you know, probably not as effective and also for the client, and probably not as profitable for us.
So when you look out across the agency sector, who is it you admire? Who's doing good work?
I spend my whole time admiring other people's work. It's funny, like you can look at, God, that's good, that's great. You know, like, and I've done that for years. But I respect any of them that have, you know, been able to, no one's kind of just Johnny come lately, really. I think it's people who've sustained that success, because I know how that it is tough to sustain it over a period of time, you know, for more than 10 years, I would say. So, yeah, I mean, Steve and Jamie at M&C Saatchi are, you know, great mates of mine.
Steve will be listening down in Australia.
Yeah, hi, Stevie. You know, so, you know, they've become good mates, and we, you know, we're competitors, but, you know, mutual respect. I certainly respect all the work that they do. But across all different verticals, I look at the work that some other agencies do, you know, I mean, obviously I still have huge respect for what Matthew Freud's done over the years and the things that he can achieve. But, you know, there's really good PR agencies in the marketplace you look at, like Taylor Herring have done some great work. And, you know, James Herring, again, is a great mate of mine. I've known from when he, you know, 20 years ago. And so there's a long list of people I look at and think, you know, they've done really well.
Okay, right, we're going to have a quick round of overrated, underrated. This is a game that everyone's talking about, obviously, across the sports business.
I have heard this on your I do think it's, as well as your, you know, jingly music, which is quite catchy.
Yeah, Sean found that. He found it on the internet somewhere, I think. I don't think we paid for that. Anyway, first underrated, overrated, we go with Wayne Rooney.
He is overrated.
And why, pray?
I just feel he was, as a Man United fan, he was capable of great moments, but too often are not great matches. So his showreel is epic. And he does things that are, you know, of right up there with Cristiano Ronaldo and Lionel Messi. But he wouldn't, for me, it frustrated me as a fan that he didn't often enough run the match, you know, like his talent could have done. So I think he was very talented, but for whatever reason, I you know, and obviously because he was the big star of English football, the media put him right out there. Yeah. But I personally think he's a bit overrated.
Okay, right. So next one, Ed Woodward.
Well, I just read that thing that Mike Ashley just said to him about the Newcastle United, Man United game, where he said this is the second most least popular person in football meeting the most unpopular person. Did you see that? Which was quite good. So the point is that Ed Woodward's rating at the moment is, you know, in the gutter, right? So my view on the Manchester United person, and this is what you look about of sport as a whole now, and you learn a lot of this by looking at American sports as well. I would compare it also, by the way, to looking at industries. If you analyse businesses, you've got to look at the ownership. Okay, we always all this pantomime about the manager, all this, that, and the other. I can look at it. The manager of a football club is actually like that, the CMO, right? They're in charge of the marketing, and the best campaign is when you hire a centre forward who scores the goal. You know, Ed Woodward is the CEO. But it's a company that is seriously underperforming, that's doing really badly. Now, in a company that's doing really badly, you look at the board and the shareholders. Now, I've never met Ed Woodward, so I don't know his capability or whatever. So I can't personally comment. All I can say is, I say the same with whether it should be, they should stick with Solskjaer or whatever. This is an organization that is being run from the other side of the Atlantic, and it's not possible to run businesses of the type of Manchester United from, you know, 3,000 miles away, with a disjointed ownership group, because they are, even though they're brothers and sisters, six of them, you know, all earning 16%. It doesn't work. There's not a clear... So Ed Woodward's day must be a frickin' nightmare. Yeah. Yeah, because, they're obviously... So, yeah, he's had a shocker. There's no doubt about it. But I think the point about it is that, again, it's impossible with that. And I think Manchester United are doomed to mid-table mediocrity until a new ownership group comes in and there's a new structure at that level, regardless of whether they get a director of football or not.
So if you put David Gill in there now, you'd get the same result?
Yeah. Or the other way of looking, the managers. If you put Guardiola in at Man United now, he'd have a nightmare. If you put Klopp in at United now, he'd be having a nightmare. And then you'd see how they coped under real pressure and it would all be going pear-shaped. Similarly, if you put Solskjaer in at Man City, he might not do as well as Guardiola. There'd be a margin of difference, but he'd do pretty well. You know what I mean? So I think because, you know, both City and Liverpool are at the top because they've got great ownership groups investing, not just in players, but the organisation structure as a whole. They're running them really, really well. And that's Man United's issue now, is that their competition has raised the game and way the clubs are organised and run at every level. And you see that from a marketing point of view about what they're doing. So, I mean, Ed Woodward and Richard Arnold, you know, probably, in the context of that, are probably doing a brilliant job.
Okay, next up is Sports Personality of the Year, BBC Sports Personality of the Year. Now, I know your views on this. You're going to say it is overrated, and why?
The event itself is just so screwed up. It's like, just put it back into it's a TV event, so put it in a TV studio. So this whole political correctness, we've got to do it. So it's a crap show to watch on telly. It's crap when you're there. And, you know, and then I get it, they have to do it in the regions, but I don't actually get it because it's being aired free to air throughout the country. So why, you don't have to broadcast it in Aberdeen for it to be for everybody. It is for everybody, you know, so just broadcast it because the problem is you can't get any talent to go to Aberdeen in December. So therefore the whole format sucks. And, you know, it's just, plus it's just, yeah. And it's never representative of really what, you know, it's never really representative of you know, like what's going on in, you know, like the industry as a whole, I don't think. And yeah, it's the Eurovision of sport, you know, but just on our own little island. So totally overrated. Sorry, Barbara Slater and everybody, turn over. And I think if a 13-year-old sports mad lad doesn't want to watch it, then you've got problems, haven't you? And that's probably a good litmus test for lots of things in sport, I think. I think, you know, like if you put lots of things in front of them, if a 13-year-old kid who loves everything about, you know, all sorts of sports, follows everything, plays everything, and they can, like, quit, change channel, then, you know, that sort of is probably quite a good piece of consumer research right there.
Okay, last one. American sports, when they come to London, what about them? Overrated, underrated?
I've been very lucky to go to a lot of American sports in America, and I'm afraid they're nowhere near what they're like when they're in America. So yeah, when they come to London, they're overrated because there's a lot of hoopla, and it shows you how it's so difficult to bring that, because American sports, NFL, college football, NBA, it's like, look, we've had lots of successful games we've promoted for the NBA in London, and they've sold out and they've been good. But it's just, it's always a weird mix because you don't have the thing that makes sports so brilliant in a home crowd with a small stadium, away crowd. It's that febrile nature of a sports event where you think it could go off at any minute. That's what makes sports so dynamic for me, you know, so exciting to watch, whether it be a football match or, you know, a rugby match, whatever it is. And I think as good a job as the American sports do of bringing the whole circus to town, and don't, you know, the NBA and the NFL have done a brilliant job, and we've been very spoiled and this in London to have the games we have, it's just not the same as being in the Arrowhead Stadium to watch the Kansas City Chiefs on a Sunday afternoon, you know, or being in Madison Square, well, not to see the Knicks because they're rubbish, but, you know, to be in, you know, American Airlines Arena to see the Heat or whatever, you know, it's not the same because the fan base in the audience obviously is mixed, you know, and so it's weird, isn't it? You go to an NFL game and it's mixed. And also, it's a bit weird that whilst they're quite good games, they're not, you know, they're never quite at the sharp end. So they're regular season games, but they're always...
Right, final question. The big eventer, American sports over here particularly, it's based on bringing in the big eventer as a demographic group. So overrated, underrated?
I think actually the big eventer underrated. I think they're critical. They're the scale that drives all the value in sport, i.e. the media value. And you know, and then subsequently commercial values. I think without the big event, you don't get that reach, and without the reach, you don't get the money.
But is not the NFL here just full of big eventers versus the NFL over there, which is about real fans, them and us?
Well, no, but it's hard to compare because the NFL is just so much bigger in America, because everyone is a big eventer on a Sunday afternoon. I mean, I literally was in America 2 weeks ago. I was walking through an airport on a Sunday. And it, literally everyone was talking about it. Lots of people are called doom and gloom about Americans, but it's just so, and you know, it's way more than here actually in terms of the amount of, you know, time it consumes and people talk about it. And I think, and then, so they're not people who are hardcore, they might not go to games, but they're big eventers, and that's why the sports industry is so big in America, because it's kind of, and obviously that's manifested itself most of all at the Super Bowl when you have 100 million plus people watching it, because, you know, because everything else going around it. And I think, I think when it comes to London, it's not big eventers. I think you have more hardcore NFL fans who go to, and they've done a great job of building the audience. But, and I think when they do things like the Regent Street stuff, they probably start to go into that big eventer parade. But I think, you know, the next stage would be how do they really get the scale over here that, you know, you get when the Cricket World Cup's on, or where, you know what it's like when you reach that tipping point in the UK where suddenly, you know, we're kind of all in, and the numbers just go to, you know, 10 million plus and all the rest of it. And that's only sport can do that, right? You know, in terms of that audiences, when you really reach the big event. So I think I think the big eventer in sports and the marketing of sports is absolutely a critical component.
Okay, Henry, thanks very much. That was great. And as ever, thank you for your time.
Good luck. Production. Good luck with it. Can we do it at the jingly music?